taken up with an interest in interspecies communication, which has become a hot item lately, as some of you may have noticed, and therefore had thought to concentrate mainly on experiments and on the results and the characteristics of experiments with chimpanzees and dolphins. But I began to become more aware that among the other beasts of some interest, there were some others that I might want to use, one of them being the human. So I'll read, start off by reading a poem about the most popular kind of experiment that we know of, the experiments that use chimpanzees, and then work my way through the zoo from there. This first poem, called The Beast in the Machine, deals with an experiment involving a chimp named Lana, who is locked in a plexiglass box, which through which she can only communicate by using a computer. If she can manipulate the computer correctly, she can achieve various satisfactions. She can not only communicate with people outside, but she can get from dispensers which are connected to her plexiglass cell such lovelies as Coca-Cola and M&Ms. For those of you who are used to my MO, I usually do what is politely known as borrow. I think it'd be closer to say I steal what I can from various sources. What happens is that the technique of writing epigraphs has become kind of epidemic with me, and the poem breaks out in a rash of quotations. I hope you'll recognize when I end and the quotations begin, but if not, I don't know that it will hurt. The first poem is called The Beast in the Machine. It begins with an epigraph from a book called Language Learning by a Chimpanzee by Dwayne Rumbaugh. To provide social contact, it was first decided that an orangutan, Fiji, would live in the language training situation with Lana. Lana scowls at the keyboard. She knows why I call these plastic wafers keys. She wonders which one unlocks BG and where I have hidden the days of their ignorance in this plexiglass Eden, tickling, grooming, hugging, sharing, tussling under the Guggenheim tree. She was both interfering with Lana's work on the keyboard and restricting Lana's linguistic expressions to requests for the barest necessities. Please, machine, give Coke. Please, machine, give M&M. Sagely, the monitor blinks, an electronic angel. A relay hisses in the wall, and there is Coke, dark, sweet, stinging her tongue with pleasure. Click, click, there is M&M, wafer of eternal bliss, body of the machine. Through the plexiglass, the banked dispensers glow. But where has she gone, sweet orange BG, silly, irresistible BG, dangling from the go bar, brushing the console with her toes? Distracted, Lana taps out, please, machine, make movie for 30 seconds of primate growth and development, which she knows by heart, her genesis in Technicolor. Then it's back to the non-stop night and day commercial of the dispensers. Quite possibly, the various incentives, such as movies, had held little reward value for Lana as long as she had the companionship of another ape. Please, machine, open She scans the console for the key to window for a glimpse of the action east of Eden in the valleys of Nod, where the technicians stray, white-robed and slim. Between the hunger and the monkey chow lies the machine. Between the boredom and the colored slides, the machine, which once, toward morning, she entreated, "Please tickle, Lana," clapped in her plastic cage, tapping out telegrams to the remote, elusive genius of the machine. Her name and the machine's are one. All she needs is a lab coat and a PhD. One of the other chimps using a different method was taught to communicate with human beings by manipulating plastic counters, each one standing for a different word or connective. One of the connectives, for instance, is if-then, and she was therefore able to, in some cases, manipulate her keepers as they tried to manipulate her. One of the problems that I discovered was characteristic of all work with animals in interspecies communication research is that, as John Lilly put it, you have to get the attention of the dolphin. This means you've got to get the dolphin, take him away, her away from her ordinary context, from her ordinary population, and set her up alone with none of her own kind. This causes certain difficulties, which anybody who's been horny for a little while knows about. This poem is called Of Course, and begins with an epigraph from a book called Intelligence in Ape and Man, I believe in half of that at least, by David Primack. By the time of her fourth cycle, however, she twice attacked her previously favored trainers. The actual causes of the attacks are unknown, of course. When Sarah came into her fullness, she had been 7 years from home, laboring in the rational vineyard, having not once laid eyes in all that time on a male of her own persuasion, till Walnut, bright, obliging Walnut, came. She reached through the bars and, clutching him close, took his unfledged Peter in her mouth, scrotum and all, whereupon the trainer whipped out his clipboard and his flare. For a brief period, Walnut was used as a contingent event. Don't you like this terminology? On a board outside her cage, we wrote such things as, "Sarah is good, if then Mary gives Sarah Walnut," and the more explicit, "Sarah insert cracker red dish, if then Mary give Sarah Walnut." Instructions of this kind restored Sarah's work habits. There are, of course, alternatives. Take Lucy, who married a vacuum cleaner. When her labia bloomed like some carnivorous flower, she dropped her magazine and plugged him in, ran his gleaming nozzle over her body, switching from suck to blow. Until she had what I inferred to be an orgasm, she laughed, looked happy, and stopped suddenly. She then turned off the machine, picked up her unfinished glass of gin and her magazine. Or take the goose who courted the garbage can. 3 furious years he defended his mate from the garbage men and danced the triumph dance under her vacant, battered gaze, mounted her in season, his wings, his heart aflutter. He would never react to Greylag calls or even to females, but if you'd just rattle a piece of metal, he would immediately act as if there were another gray lag calling him in the distance. When they carried his lady off for keeps, he watched them flatten her in the crusher, heard her death rattle, then followed the garbage hearse, of course, 2 blocks through the deafening traffic till he was crushed himself. One thing I began to discover was that certain other areas in which I had been doing some research, very unlikely areas, proved to offer similar situations. One of those involved the initial meetings of Europeans, mostly English, with Arctic Eskimos. This one deals with Martin Frobisher's account of his second voyage, in which at first he picked up in one, what he calls an encounter, I assure you it was bloody, one Eskimo, and then in a second encounter, another Eskimo of the opposite sex. And then he wanted to see what they do together. The scientific impulse was intense. This is the poem. It incorporates not only Frobisher's account, but an account I make up that the savage makes of the encounter. The word kabluna, which I refer to in the poem, means white man. It's called Another Matter, and begins with a quote from Frobisher's account of his second voyage. What knowledge they have of God, or what idol they adore, we have no perfect intelligence. I think them rather anthropophagi, or devourers of man's flesh, than otherwise. For that there is no flesh or fish which they find dead, smell it ever so filthily, but they will eat it. From the first encounter, all escaped but one, huddled in the forestays, scowling like a Tartar in his bloody skins. Now, from the last transaction, this old witch, lost in her furs like a withered root. When the men first flung her to the deck, they tore her moccasins off to see if her feet were cloven. Very strange and beastly, maggots nuzzling the salmon, seal guts spread on a stone to dry. Bleeding from a scalp wound, the younger female croons over an injured girl child, barely tubed, hugging to her meager breast one arm like a bloody dog. Our surgeon, meaning to heal her child's arm, applied salves thereunto. But she, not acquainted with such kind of surgery, plucked those salves away, and by continual licking with her own tongue, not much unlike our dogs, healed up the child's arm. Strange, strange, exceedingly strange, the mother's cheek tattooed in broad blue strokes, her lank locks glistening with blood. The man's salvage formerly taken and she brought together, every man with silence desired to behold the manner of their meeting, which was more worth the beholding than can be well expressed. A good space that they beheld, each one the other, speechlessly, as if the grief of captivity had riven their tongues. Then the young female turned her face to the wall, and crooning, soft as a wounded dove, began to sing, as though she minded another matter. Ice mother, your light smiles from the snow crust, winks at the sun. He trudges past you, brushing your hummocks with his red knuckles. Ice mother, mighty stillness, we drowse on your breast the long night. Through the skin of your cold blue eye, we fish for our dinner. But being again brought together, the man broke up the silence first, and with a stern and staid countenance, began to tell a long, solemn tale. Beside me, one brute fell, an arrow through the spleen, while of the people, three died on the beach. Yet strove while their arrows lasted, then gathered Kabluna's arrows, then snatched the arrows from their wounds and let those fly. And I saw from the bow of this demon canoe an old man bleeding leap from the cliff. And another I saw, then another, that they should not be taken, leap while the rest escaped. Whereunto she gave good hearing, and interrupted him nothing till he had finished, and afterwards, being grown into more familiar acquaintance by speech, they were turned together, and together, and together, each rarely out of the other's sight, as if they could not bear to be alone. Yet never were they seen in all that time to use as man and wife, though she made his bed and dressed his meat, though she nursed him through his final illness, scrupulous as any Christian, she bathed him, crooning, her eyes turned to the wall, as though she minded another matter. One last poem dealing with the sexual complications which occur in attempting to communicate with various kinds of animals. And I point out that Frobisher communicated with the Eskimos by sign, which is the common way to deal nowadays with primitive beasts. This poem deals with dolphins. The poem is called And the experiment involved about a 6-week stay together of a dolphin named Peter and a really perceptive woman, tremendously more perceptive than John Lilly, her boss, named Margaret Howe, in a wet environment. It meant that that Margaret never left the enclosed space completely. At least her ankles were always in the water. Her bed was in the center of the pool, raised up but usually quite wet, and surrounded with a sheet just so that she could get a little peace every once in a while. But for the most part, she spent her time with Peter. Peter kept approaching her in various affectionate ways. The problem is that dolphin affection involves a kind of tender nibbling. Margaret's ankles got so scratched from that nibbling that the salt water began to irritate her terribly, and she had to fend him off with a broom. This is, it's going to be a little hard to read Peter's part because I can't quite speak Delphinese. "I am completely vulnerable to him," Margaret says in the mind of the dolphin. "And he pushes and shoves my legs and feet and quite pathetically tries to satisfy himself. I can feel his mounting frustration. All night the lady tosses in her sodden sheets, shedding her own salt tears on the briny pillow. All night Peter's tail whap-whaps the water. Restless wavelets twitch the flimsy curtain. Uneasy shadows flounder on the ceiling. Her ankles sting from the nicks of his teeth. But for all her human guile and feminine wit, it's Peter who teaches and Margaret who's taught. Playing, he lets his favorite ball roll back in his mouth, parting his teeth in a permanent smile, as if to say, 'Come, I won't hurt you.' I stand very still, legs slightly apart, and Peter slides his mouth gently over my shin. His mouth opens all the way, and he begins up and down my leg, then the other leg. A month of this salty courtship, till one evening, in the second moon of their togethering, he lets the ball slip from his mouth entirely, and rolling on his side, approaches. Margaret says, 'Margaret,' Peter answers, click, 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 click. Margaret says, yes, yes, that's an M. Let's do it again. Say, Margaret. Click, 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 click. And one last complex sexual encounter. This one, again, involving a questionable human being. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with the wild child or the wild boy of Aberdour. He was discovered in France in, as I recall, the end of the 17th century, the end of the 18th century, sorry. He had been living in the woods for nobody knows how long. Nobody knew exactly how old he was, but they guessed he was somewhere around 13 or 14. He could not speak. He could not eat like a human being. He lacked his water directly from the stream. He ate his food raw until he learned how to cook potatoes, in which case he put the potatoes in the fire, waited for a while, and then plucked them out with his hand and ate them hot. I refer in this to the doctor, who is Jean-Marc Gaspard-Itard, who tried to teach the wild child, whose name was Victor, to speak, which was extremely difficult because he was never quite sure whether he could hear completely. And it was clear that he had passed the age when speech was a possibility. He did teach him, more or less, to become a social animal. But the person who really communicated with him again and who dealt with him throughout all of his life, Itard gave up after about 5 years in exasperation. And the other person, his governess, so to speak, Madame Guérin, took him to live in a little house where they spent the rest of their life. Victor died at 43. Must have been a very strange couple, living on a kind of cross between welfare and a government grant. This poem is called His Need, and it starts with a quote from Itard's book, The Wild Boy of Aveyron. I did not doubt that if I dared to reveal to this young man the secret of his restlessness and the aim of his desires, an incalculable benefit would have accrued. 3 Sundays running in the second year, Madame Guérin woke to hear him crying in his room, no, calling, as a bird calls from his perch in the first glimmer of false dawn. Lee, Lee, Lee. 3 sounds the wild child learned to fatten his orphan dialect of mutter and grunt, chuckle and howl. First there was O, which he answered to like a name, but couldn't bring himself to say. Then Lay, the infant grace the doctor coaxed him to chant over milk. And now this warbling at the brink of light, this sweet, unmediated Lee, Lee, Lee. How many Sundays was it Julie had joined them for dinner, her faultless Julie of the downcast eyes, the forthright breasts that could impale a saint, provoke not a sound, but a psalm of longing, a song such as infant Solomon might croon in his cradle, Julie, Julie. I have seen him in a company of women attempting to relieve his uneasiness by sitting beside one of them and gently taking hold of her hand, her arms, and her knees. No more. That meek charade once over, he thrust her away and sought another soft, recalcitrant shape and another, till, gently taking hold of her hand, he drew one woman into the alcove, circled her pensively, then flung his arms round her, slender, sinewy, half savage, half boy. She was the last he ever touched till the day of his death, but for Madame, and that was only when she had been away too long, He clung to her, shuddering like a child who'd given up hope. This resignation has served only to exasperate him and has led the unfortunate creature to find nothing but a cause for despair in an imperious need. For all the doctor's soothing baths and violent exercise, the storm in Victor gathered, tossing him from agony to grief to rage. One morning he sank his teeth in her hand. The tempest guttered like a candle. Aghast, he knelt to kiss the wound, his wild heart fluttering in its cage, blood trickling thickly from nostril and ear. On the other hand, suppose I had been permitted to try such an experiment. Would I not have been afraid to make known to our savage a need which he would have sought to satisfy as publicly as his other wants, and which would have led him to acts of revolting indecency? Her husband dead these 20 years, her man-boy dead at 43, 1 week now, in the tiny house, Madame remembers. What was the pretext? Pressing her ear to Victor's door. Remembers the latchkey turning slowly so many years and lives ago, how, hunched on his bed, stroking his lonely, half-boy, half-man root, he gazed across the altar of his need. What does the doctor know of need? 3 times this week alone she's waked in the empty house to nothing at all, to a cry like a fishbone caught in her throat. Victor, 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 Victor. Let me read a couple of poems dealing with a more pleasanter aspect of the various kinds of experiments and studies with animals. This one is called The Ape Who Painted. It begins with an epigraph, and this is one of the only ones which doesn't break out in epigraphs like a rash. Toward the end of his painting career, Congo was producing excellent circles, but nearly always filled them in immediately. It's from a book called The Artistic Animal by Alexander Allen, Jr. Those of you who are O fillers, who spend time on your board filling in O's, might understand what he was doing. Toward the end, the painter was subject to sudden fits of aimless pacing, sucking the end of his brush. His lips were permanently Indian red, a pigment to which he had grown obsessively partial. From time to time, he would pause to examine an apple, turning it in his long, sensitive fingers, or fish a dust mouse gently from under his bed, not a hair displaced, or moon for hours sprawled on his favorite tire, praying to his thumb. How fortunate we are to have captured on film this miraculous thumb, in full career, sweeping in a great assured arc from left to right, trailing a gleaming Indian red parabola counterclockwise, following its own law, tailing up again towards its beginning, deftly dividing out from in, then filling carefully the bowl of zero with precious red, horizon to horizon. Toward the end, the painter's cage was strewn with fallen suns, great bloody periods, pages from some cosmic calendar, while he grew more taciturn than ever. And one about the art of whales. I don't know how many of you have heard the two records that have been made of humpback songs, but they're fairly compelling, I guess is the word I'm looking for. In the second batch, Roger Payne, who wrote a little article called Humpbacks, Their Mysterious Songs, noted something really fascinating. The whales he was studying, the humpbacks that he was studying, sang a particular song at the beginning of a season when they gathered up, I believe it was off the Great Barrier Reef. And he noticed that as the summer progressed, the austral summer progressed, the song would repeat itself. All the whales sang the same song, though at different times. That is, they were not in concert, but they did sing more or less together. But the song was always the same, with very faint changes. And the minute one whale made a change in the song, the other whales would pick it up and incorporate the change into the song. Very, very slowly, by the end of the season, the song had changed quite radically. Then they would swim away to the Antarctic, and the next season when they came back, they would start exactly where they had left off, and the song would progress through another season. This poem is called Whale Canticle and begins with a little epigraph from Roger Payne. The song appears to be evolving. Late March, the last vast shapes appear, grazing the pack off Cape Adare, sifting the dark all austral summer, ruminating the same long thought. As the new green rubbery ice appears in the indigo lanes, one matriarch muses how nice it must be north this time of year at Barrier Reef. It's barely a month before she blows. In the chill gray noon, her spume appears to hang an instant, glimmering dimly, a bush of needles on the long, low swell. By May, on the reef, fat calves appear, cavorting in the rings their mothers make, their elf cries lapped by the widening rings of the song, as one by one they all take up where they left off last year. Wrapped in that music, some appear to be keeping time with their barnacle-crusted flippers, but never together, each in her own sweet time. Now one perfects the second theme, another tries it on, another, as the canticle takes shape in the warm blue wave. How nice, they never get all of it right at once. And one last poem, which sort of incorporates a number of these themes, called By Our Signs. I refer in it to a boat called the Gabriel. The Gabriel was the ship that Frobisher used on his first voyage to America, to the Arctic. And during that voyage, a group of his men rowed off in one of his lifeboats and disappeared. He assumed that they were killed by those savages. They were probably looking for gold. But he spent a great deal of time trying to find them, and he blamed everything that happened thereafter on the Eskimos. And he kept trying to demand from them that they return his men, or at least the boat. He never got either one back. By Our Signs, a quote from Hakluyt, The English Voyages. The stones of this supposed continent with America be altogether sparkled and glister in the sun like gold. So likewise doth the sand in the bright water. The dolphin in the plastic hammock has learned to gurgle, "Good morning, Dr. Lily," through his spiracle. The ape Washoe has learned to curse in fluent semaphore. By their signs we shall know them. Waiting for a sign of the prodigal five who'd vanished rowing the Gabriel's skiff round the stony point for a sack of sparkle, for a fistful of glister. They are greatly delighted with anything that is bright. All day the captain held at anchor, all eyes scouring the shore, and next morning, sailing close as he dared to the cannibals' camp, he sounded the Gabriel's trumpet, fired off a cannon. By his signs, unequivocal, by his trumpet and gun, they knew him. They arose from the huts, an answering blare of laughter, very strange and beastly. And the captain swore never again to make peace with those savages, spoke from that hour only the language of reprisal, the laying on of arms. By our signs they shall know us. I pluck a louse from Washoe's fur and crack it with my teeth. I swim out, flapping my black plastic tail, crying, "Uncle, uncle," in clicks and squeals.